All right, so this is Publishing 101, right? I'm in the right place? Okay, well, this is Publishing 101, which obviously means we're going to talk about how to self-publish. Depending on what you're making, board games, role-playing games, books, we can adequately cover most of those. I will... Thank God. I stalled long enough.
We hadn't seen you. Welcome.
Thank you.
In fact, why don't you take this chair by the microphone? Oh. Because I don't need to be here.
Oh, I'm usually loud enough that I don't need a microphone.
Well, they're recording, so.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Well, that's different then.
Okay, good. Well, I guess since I started the intro, I'll just finish it off real quick. My name's Phil Vecchione. I'm one of the partners at Encoded Designs, a small publishing company that's published, a dozen different things so far, from some supplements to role-playing games. We have a couple of board games that were in late stage, ready for publication kind of thing. Been in business, 4 years, I think?
Yeah, I think 4 years. Right?
4 years. There's six of us that are part of Encoded Designs. We can talk a little bit more about that and some of the roles that we all have in a bit.
My name is Eric Simon. I am a couple of things. So first of all, I am a small publisher myself. I have been a Savage Worlds licensee for a few years, doing a setting called Steamscapes. I've also recently released a book for Fate called Rockalypse, and have other things that are in the works for the future, both in and out of those systems. I'm also the social media manager and a number of other things, including Kickstarter coordinator, customer service fulfillment. I do a lot of things for Ulysses North America, which is the English language division for Ulysses Spiel. We do things like The Dark Eye, Torg Eternity, soon to be Fading Suns, and the upcoming Wrath and Glory, which will be the new 40K role-playing game. So I handle a lot of the back end of that high-end Kickstarter and fulfillment, and I've done a lot of Kickstarters there. I've also done some freelance writing and advising on other people's Kickstarters, so I have become kind of the person to ask in the Chicago area of, hey, I want to do a Kickstarter, how do I do that? So I can answer a lot of those questions.
Hi, my name is Vicky Beaver. I'm from Apatron Productions, and you might be getting the idea that people in the RPG industry wear a ton of hats. That would be the right idea. Just as Phil and Eric have mentioned, I do multiple things. I am the co-owner. There are two of us. My husband's hiding in the back corner and choosing not to participate today. So he and I are the two people who are behind Apatron Productions. We've been Savage Worlds licensees for a few years. One of the first things we did was create a supernatural, a tribal fantasy setting called Tunzeal, and then we did another one that is still in production called Retribution. That's the supernatural fantasy. In between those two, we took over from Mystical Throne Entertainment, Savage Insider, which is a magazine devoted to Savage Worlds. As a matter of fact, both of these gentlemen to my right, your left, have had their pieces published in Savage Insider. So after some personal things, because that's what happens in the RPG industry, when you have tiny little companies, sometimes things don't go according to plan, so Savage Insider's been on hiatus for a while and is finally going to be released September 15th. Yay! So my expertise in the RPG industry is kind of scattered. I've worked with my own company. I've worked with other companies. I've done a lot of editing for a few different companies. So wearing multiple hats, layout design. If you're a layout designer, you can almost write your own ticket. So layout design. They're short in the industry. I don't do illustration, that I farm out. Writing, editing, dealing with rules, dealing with freelancers, getting people paid, doing the back end of stuff. So there's a lot of things that you can get your hands into in the RPG industry, whether you are starting for yourself or trying to plug in with other companies.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think we'll split time between taking questions and I think just covering...
Yeah.
Covering different things. The topic of wearing many hats, I think, is a really good one. But I guess, I think to get started, trying to think if, well, I guess maybe we should talk about, we could all share our own thoughts about how to go from idea from a high level, idea through publishing, because there are a number of steps. And a lot of people get started by having written something in a manuscript, and they're like, oh, I'm going to publish it, only to discover that you're, like, on the top of the iceberg, and you haven't seen how much of it's underwater at that point.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah. The writing of the material, I think, is probably... I don't want to say easy, because it's definitely not easy. The writing part and then the developing... So I don't know if you guys use different terminology, but at Encoded, we use design and development as two separate terms. Designer is the person who is making up rules, and developer is the one who's looking at it going, I don't think that's going to work. Like, you got to fix this. You got to change this. It's not going to hold up in testing, that kind of thing. So there's that part, the creation part. So design, develop, playtest, design, develop, playtest. That just goes around. But at some point, well, I guess start there. At some point, you're going to say, I have a thing. And it's good. I want to share it with other people, and I would like to make money in doing so. So for Encoded, that process for us, and then I think maybe we can go down the line. For us, that process, after we have something that we consider ready to publish, is a editing pass. So in Encoded, there's, again, six of us. So we have a lead editor whose job is to read through, fix everything structurally, so grammar, spelling if there's any problems, consistency issues, wording, that kind of thing. Then it goes through a proofing phase. So Bob is responsible for that. We call him the eyes. His job is, even after the editor, there's still things that'll be found. Bob's job is a lot of spot fixing, as well as consistency. That includes consistency across chapters. So if we used a term here, did we use the same term 10 chapters later, that kind of thing. After that, it goes into layout. And so parallel to that, we're acquiring artwork. So we can talk about it as a separate thing, but we're acquiring artwork all during that period, maybe even before. The artwork and the words all get together. Tim Jones, who's here in the video game room, then takes all that and lays it out into a book. Then we proof it again. In this case, we're not only still proofing words, but we're also making sure, did we cut anything off with illustrations? Is the flow look weird? That kind of thing. Then we do the most gruesome part, where the entire company, all six of us, goes through the book one last time. That's excruciating. We all hate it. And then we consider it ready for release. So that's like our, I mean, we're pretty standard about that. That is pretty much our standard product, whether we're doing a full book or a PDF supplement. Everything goes through that chain. How about you?
So if you are solo, you have to do every single one of those steps. So I'll talk about that too. So the tricks that you are going to have to figure out are, which of those steps do you feel comfortable and confident in doing right now? Which of those steps do you think you'll be okay becoming good at? And which of them can you absolutely not do ever on your own, period? That's one of the first things that you are going to have to sort out as a solo designer, developer. So anything that you absolutely know that you cannot do yourself, you have to immediately start trying to find people. It is super important, I feel, to set set the precedent immediately of, I'm going to pay people, I'm going to pay them as soon as possible. I am not going to do any kind of delays on payment. I'm going to be professional up front, even though I am not, published yet. I'm going to be professional to everyone I work with. I think that is extremely important.
Can I ask you to define two terms?
Yes.
So for people who are possibly starting into the industry, can you define pay on acceptance versus
yes.
pay on publication?
So pay on publication, you should never do. Because especially as a small publisher, you cannot guarantee publication. Also, there's a certain expectation with pay on publication, which is the idea that I'm going to pay you your share once the book is out in the world and I'm getting money for it, then I can give you your money. So as a small-time publisher, that's going to take a long time. And even if you get it out into the world, it may be a long time before you start to see even recoup of the investment you've put into it, let alone profit. So pay on acceptance is much, much preferable for everything that you do. And when you set that, people are going to be more willing to work with you. First of all, when you say, here is exactly the terms, when I accept your work by these deadlines, here are the deadlines that you'll follow, assuming everything's cool with that, I will accept it, and then within 30 days I will pay you, period. That is generally what I say, and I put it in writing and I sign it every single time. Mm-hmm. You can definitely get boilerplate contracts, but do it. And I have had situations where I have fired writers, and I've still, because I do 50% up front, I go beyond pay on acceptance. So I do 50% up front for both art and writing, and because I fired that writer, I still let him keep that 50%. And that is, as much as it hurt, that was something that I felt to be important, because that is, I am establishing myself. And it's not just about saying to the rest of the world, hey, I'm serious about this, I'm professional about this. It is saying it to yourself, because when you start to make that investment, you are committing to doing it. It is a truism in all creative endeavors. Ideas are cheap. And people, when you start to say to people, I'm a game designer and I am publishing this, they're going to start telling you all their ideas. And they're going to believe that that is equivalent. Ideas are cheap. Work is your stock in trade. So put the effort into it, and that is what makes you professional. And so by committing to pay on acceptance and to getting, when people are starting to put together Kickstarters, I tell them, yeah, pay for some art right now. Mm-hmm. Do that. Because you want art on your Kickstarter, but also you're committing to this project by doing that, because you're investing in it. So it is something that I consider important.
I mean, I can give a real quick example. So every writer takes a bad contract. Mm-hmm. So I took a pay on publication contract. I finished my work, turned it in. 9 months later, I got my first royalty from that book. So for 9 months, I got nothing.
Mm-hmm. So I will add to that. Not trying to outdo the worst story.
But I did
the same thing Phil did. I took a contract, and the idea was, I will pay you a percentage of the sale. So first off, never do that. Because unless you know people have worked for the company and you have an established record of actually getting some money from sales and money that they felt was worth their time, don't do it. So I took a contract, signed it for the company, and that was what it was. It was, I'll pay you a percentage of our sales. Now, I never got paid for more than one project that I worked for. One of the projects never even got published,
yep,
as we were mentioning.
That's the
out. I had no kill fee. So there was no kill fee for me having done hundreds of hours of work. And I'm not talking hundreds of words of work. I'm talking hundreds of hours of work. So beware of accepting or offering percentage of sales solutions for getting people. One of the things I would encourage you to do is consider that, well, actually, let me ask this question. Have we asked the audience what their goals
nope.
are?
So okay, should,
so let me do that. So I can be sure that that the group of us are actually speaking to what your interests are. So who is interested in being a freelancer in the industry, just maybe doing some editing or illustrating or some writing? Okay, so we've got folks who are interested more in freelance. Are there folks who are interested in actually becoming developers, RPG publishers? Okay, so and for the folks in the back, where are you on the spectrum of what your interest is?
Just learning
about the industry in general. Okay, great. So there are tons of things that
so
we could tell you about.
General information
in general
is useful.
All right, fantastic. Okay. So As freelancers, I would very much caution you to be conscientious of some of those terms that Phil and Eric just mentioned and some of those things that we just mentioned. If you are looking at a new company, no, they're not going to have lots of money to pay you. But if they're not willing to pay you anything at all until they get some sales, then they are not putting any skin in the game for the work you're doing. One of the way there are different ways to approach this. One of the ways I approach it with Savage Insider is kind of a hybrid of some of the solutions that these gentlemen mentioned. As a publisher, because of my experiences like what Phil had described, I swore I would never accept free work. Mm-hmm. I have had offers because I had run behind on Savage Insider by more than a year now. It's been more than a year that we've published. I've had offers, well, I'll do this for free. I'm like, no, you won't. Thank you for offering. That's very generous, but no, you won't. I've had the previous publisher offer to take it back. I said, well, just hold tight for a bit. But I wouldn't accept free work because, again, what these gentlemen were saying, establishing that, what Eric said specifically, that in my mind, I want to be the publisher that people know that if they do work for, that they are going to get money. And my policy has always been, before I publish it, you will get paid. It may be 3 days before I'm publishing it, but you will get paid before I'm making any money off of it. The reason I do that is because I don't want anyone to ever feel that, okay, well, she's had my work and she's making money off of it, but where's mine? So I don't want anybody to do that. Be willing when you're new in the industry to consider things that are not free, but that are very, very inexpensive. Because when we are small, sometimes that's the case. Sometimes, you know, I have my rates per word for the magazine published on our website, so you know before you ever even pitch an idea to us or volunteer to illustrate for us. And by volunteer, I mean put your name in the bucket to get paid, not actually free work. You know ahead of time what you're likely to get. If you're putting in a pitch for a 2,000-word article, you know 2,000 times rate of pay for the feature that you're choosing to submit. This is the likelihood of what I'm going to get paid. I say likelihood because I also edit. I'm not going to pay someone for 2,000 words when it really should have been 1,500 words because they use 500 words way too many. So don't waste my time by giving me extra stuff. Don't waste your time by giving me extra stuff, even if it's within the 2,000-word criteria. So I pay, and that's clear too. I pay you for the edited word. So if you give me 2,000, mm-hmm. I cut 200, I'm paying you for 1,800 because that's what I'm actually publishing. So be aware of those kinds of nuances. I think, Eric, you mentioned contracts. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing. Even if they're not giving you an actual, here is a PDF that of it, at least have something in email that you can go back to and say, but wait, hey, this is what you told me were my deadlines. This is what you told me that I need to do for you. And if you are serious about the idea of becoming a publisher, I would encourage you to use an actual contract. Obviously, yep. Eric does. I do. Phil, does your group?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so I would encourage you to use an actual contract, but at least as a freelancer, get something in electronic writing, if nothing else, that outlines everything you're expected to do.
And most publishers will share their contracts. Like when I put mine together, I went to like three friends who were publishers and got their contracts and mm-hmm. Put them together. And in fact, right. I actually believe that I'm pretty sure that all RPG contracts derive from like some 1977 Travelers contract because everybody looks at a contract and like sees the wording from another contract. Like, so Sean Merwin's one of the members of Encoded, and he's done a lot of freelance work with WotC, and like he took a look at our contract templates, and he's like, yeah, some of this is WotC wording. And I'm like, yeah, that would make sense. Some of the stuff came from Monty Cook Games, and Monty just cribbed his stuff from WotC. And so, yeah, somehow if you do this, like, analysis of wording, like, it all comes back to, like, 1977. Somebody wrote a contract.
That's funny. I restarted. I looked at a fresh set of boilerplates, so I built mine from...
I can guarantee mine doesn't, because I wrote mine in plain language. I chose not to do legalese. I wrote it in plain language. So mine definitely doesn't look like it. But I will admit that I used the contract I signed for one company that I won't disclose, but I also will never, ever have a contract like theirs as what I'd like to avoid. So this is what is, and that's also a valid form of learning for this industry. I go by, in really any industry, for those experiences you have and you realize, I hated being treated like this, or I hated the way they worked with me on this. Maybe you liked the project, but you really hated the flow of information or lack of information, whatever the case is. You can use those experiences to design your style of working with people so that you can say, okay, I don't want to do this. You know how some of us grow up and we think, okay, I don't want to turn into my mom or my dad. Okay, think of that as, I don't want to be that publisher or that designer or that freelancer. Those kinds of things. You can, and I'm not saying that to, you know, diss someone, but to give you the idea of learning from the things you did not like can help shape a better professional position for yourself as a freelancer or as a publisher yourself, because learning from how you were treated or things that you didn't think went well or worked well or that you didn't enjoy, that helps you kind of figure out how to work with other people in a better, more professional way, or at least one that's truer to yourself as opposed to just mimicking somebody else. Although, cribbing some language that's not plagiarism because contracts are not, you know, copyrighted. Right. That I can totally understand if you, you know, if you're kind of like, I at least need a place to start.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what I did was I took three of them and I lined and I went through and highlighted them and I was like, I like this phrasing, I like this phrasing, I want this. And then ultimately, we changed ours to a contractor service agreement. So we have people only sign one contract that has all the binding stuff and then they get a work order. So if I want to work with somebody again, I don't have to recontract them. I can just issue them another work order and say, this is what I want. This is the deadline. This is how much. Right. This is the format. This is when I want it. And it's a single piece of paper. And I don't have to go back through that whole thing of, you know, hey, sign this, you sign this, I sign this.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense for your setup where you're basically working with the same team all the time.
If I'm doing something with somebody that I want to work with more than once, I do that. I mean, I have one-off contracts for a thing where it's like, okay, we're probably gonna do this one-time thing. Mm-hmm. Here's a contract to cover it. Versus like, for instance, artists. Like, you know, I mean, I have a couple favorite artists that I like to use for projects, so I have them on contract agreements so that I can just get them when I want them. And artists, I will say this, pay your artists well.
Yes.
Artists will undercut themselves. Mm-hmm. I have one artist I love, Matt Morrow. I've worked with him for years, and he will not hesitate to try to cut his rates for me, and I'm like, stop it. I'm like, I will pay you the full price. Like, I don't want you to have to go get a day job. Like, I want you to keep making art for me, so whatever it is, just so, I'll pay it.
And that's understandable, but one thing I would like to highlight is, while pay your artists appropriately, don't pay them so much more than you're paying your writers. Yeah. You are creating the content for which they are designing illustrations, because I found that has been something I've seen in RPG companies where I'm like, wait a minute, so let me get this straight. I'm spending how much time and how much energy and how much effort to create for you an entire world or this huge, you know, campaign. So I am writing this material for you. But you're paying your artist several hundred dollars, and I might possibly, if it sells, if it even sells, I might maybe make $100 or $200 off this. But you're paying several artists. You're paying a cover designer who is getting somewhere between $200 and $750 for your smaller publishers. Let's not even talk about the big wigs. You know, if we're talking who's paying the people that are doing Wizards work or, you know, doing Pathfinder's work, they're going to be getting a whole lot more than people who are doing covers for me. I promise you that. I wish I was an artist. I could do that. So, you know, if you're looking at, you're paying someone at least $200 for a cover that's designed specifically for your product. You're paying another somewhere between $10 and $100 for images that are interior designs. If you're illustrating a book at a rate of a one-quarter page illustration for every four pages, and you've got a 100-page book of some sort, do the math on that. Anybody think that the writers should get at least as much as the people who are illustrating this?
Yeah.
So, but if you are paying your artists well, don't forget you need to be paying your writers well. And those editors, Who of us has read a book and we're like, whoa, they didn't have an editor, did they?
Mm-hmm. You've actually...
Yeah. So, and then you look at the credits and you realize the editor was the same name as the writer. By the way, don't do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, thank you. That hadn't come up yet. Yes. You cannot edit your own stuff.
No.
That is not a thing. No matter how good you are, like, I have a degree, you know, I do not, but if you, like, I have a degree in English, I can totally edit my own stuff. You cannot edit your own stuff.
There's a reason why. We all see what we think we wrote. Yeah. Now, there are some caveats. If you're doing some very small work and you're going back to it 3 weeks later and looking at it again, there's, you know, that's a possibility you can do without really messing up. But by and large, absolutely don't edit your own work. You can be a writer and an editor. Just don't edit your own work. I am a writer and an editor. So you were talking about contracts where it's like if you're going to work with the same person, you kind of do something more like a work order. I have a writer whose work I've edited, and he's come back to me multiple times for other works, and that's pretty much what he did. So I edit his work. He likes what I do with his work. I don't change, and this is it's something to consider. If you're a writer, editors will try to help you express your ideas clearly and well. But if that editor is also changing your tone and your style, you might want to have a conversation as to what you really want out of your editing. If you are an editor working with writers, same thing. You might want to have a conversation with that writer when you start catching yourself changing someone's tone and style as to, wait, why am I doing that? Even though this isn't my writing, so I need to edit according to that person's tone and style, not my personal preferences. So separating your personal preferences from your professional work is a skill that it would do well for people to develop if you don't already have that knack. So in working with this, with editing, you need to be sure that you are actually keeping that person's tone and style, but you are polishing it with them. And if you are a publisher, don't forget how important it is to the end user that when they read through this, that they aren't catching a bunch of typos or a bunch of words that were missing because somewhere in there the editor changed the line and forgot to reread it, that proofreading part that you mentioned, the after the editing. So those are things that, don't forget that editing is important too, and pay those people. I mean, you may not be able to pay them 2 or 3 cents a word. You may not be able to pay them the 5 cents a word, but pay them. Because otherwise, you've got an incomplete, less professional work than you could have.
The first manuscript I ever wrote was for a book called Never Unprepared. And it was my first time writing my own, it was the first time I was writing solo. And I handed off the manuscript, and I was pretty happy with it. And when I read the book after publishing, I was like, oh, that's editing. Now I get it. That's way clearer. I was reading paragraphs, and I'm like, oh, that's my idea. That is not what I wrote. That is much better. Yeah, so editing is important. And just like you said, at Encoded, our chief editor, Sean Merwin, is also a writer and designer. So when Sean writes, Bob is his editor. And then somebody else will proof.
There you go.
Because we just can't, we can't have Sean editing his own stuff. But for everyone else, that's Sean's our go-to guy. We're at halfway, so we should answer a couple questions, and then we can talk about a few more things as well.
So does anybody have a question?
Any specific questions?
Yes.
So when you were talking about contracts before, what do you think the most important thing to include in a contract for writing one up is, and what's the most important thing for a freelancer, I guess, when they're looking at a contract to make sure is in there to make sure that they're guaranteed, both payment and, I guess, credit for the work that they're doing.
I'm going to put my project manager hat on, because by trade, by day, I'm actually also a project manager. So I will say probably the number one thing that I like as both when I get a contract and when I write a contract is the scope of work. Mm-hmm. That it is 100% clear to the person who's getting contracted, this is what you're doing, this is what I want. So if it's an artist, it's I want this illustration, see the attached document for the art write-up for what we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And it could be super detailed, I want, you know, two-head lizard man standing in a threatening pose, you know, mouth open, drool, whatever.
T is a random example.
T is a random example. Or it could simply be, I need a cyberpunk space princess. Figure out what that means. Right. Like, do something with that, then show me the first sketch. For a writer, it might be very specific. Like, here's the outline of what I want. This is how many words. So again, if you're writing, how many words are you writing? I'll tell a great story of how I got burned on a contract because I've written a bunch of contracts, but I didn't pay attention to the wording of the contract, and I got burned for $200 by a very famous person, which I will not name. although I may hint to. Anyway, that for me. So scope and deadline. When do you expect this by?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Deadlines on both sides. So submission deadlines, payment deadlines. The expectations of when payment will happen should be listed in the contract itself. And usually that is in terms of when acceptance happens. So that's usually how it should be. The other thing, and this is more of an art thing, but it's something that if you are planning to be a publisher, you should think about. Rights transferred is something that you need to be aware of. You are listing in the contract what rights are being transferred to you as the publisher. And now you can determine what that means for you, what you would prefer, but do some looking up on that. So for instance, a fairly typical one is all except third party. And that what that means is that I can't take your art and sell it to someone else to publish in their book. But I have all the rights to use your art in web and print. You specify web and print usually is how I do that. So that I'm saying it is, I can use it on my website for publicity. I can use it in the books that I am making, and that also will tend to cover promotional materials. Like if I want to make a poster using this, that's fine. I add the extra clause for artists. Artist also retains rights. That's just an extra thing that I like to do because I personally feel that artists should continue to be able to publish the art that they've submitted to me in their own collections and things like that.
I do something similar where we have a clause that says you can keep it, you can put it on your website, and you can even sell prints of it.
Yeah.
Like, we're cool. You can sell prints of it. You just can't sell this to another publisher.
Right.
So we do some similar things with that. So I think I would agree that scope and rights are really the two most important things that you're putting in there aside of payment. So really three things: scope, payment, rights. For Optar Productions, we handle our rights differently depending on whether you are doing something for us for Savage Insider or if you're doing something for us for one of our settings. If you are doing something for Savage Insider, I allow people to, you know, sell that work someplace else. Or if they've had it published someplace else, so long as you don't have an agreement otherwise with that entity, that I will reprint something that's been published someplace else. Because it's similar to the idea of with artists. I feel like if you're writing something for me for Savage Worlds and it's not something that is specific to our settings, then why not let you go ahead and try to sell it as a one-off through DriveThruRPG or through Paizo or something. So I do allow for that. But I'm also going to ask that you give me the right to reprint it in future issues where I might have collections, like a best of issue. For artists, I will pay in two different ways based on, are you giving me something that you're giving me a permission to use, or are you giving me something that you are selling me for my exclusive use? If you're selling me something for my exclusive use, then I understand you wanting to charge me a little more. But if you're going to sell it to me and you're going to sell it to Pinnacle and you're going to sell it to somebody else, then why am I paying you as if it's my own? I would expect to pay less because I'm paying you for the right to use it, not for exclusive use. And that ties into how things differ, whether I'm doing it for Savage Insider or the magazine versus for Tunzeal Retribution or any future work that we might come up with. And that is that if you are creating an illustration that is specific to my setting, then I really don't expect you to also sell it to someone else, because I'm giving you, like Phil had mentioned earlier, scope, this, you know, the lizard man, this drooling. If I am telling you that I want something that is not easily, you know, gone into something else, that this is something that should be for our exclusive use, then I really don't expect you to go selling it someplace else to another RPG company. And I'm going to have that as part of the contract, that I'm buying this as work that's specified for Opitron Productions, and that we are buying the exclusive rights to use this, with the exception of things like Eric had just mentioned, that you can use it in your portfolio. You can put it on your website. If you want to sell a single print of it, great. But I'm not expecting it to turn up in another work. So that's, you know, that's where our contracts will specify, again, depending upon what your which publication that you're working with us on. So the three things: fees, rates, you know, one and the same, scope, and rights. Those are what you really need to look for as a publisher. You make sure it's clear. And as a freelancer, you want to protect your own interest. You want to make sure, well, if I'm going to spend this time creating this artwork or this writing, am I getting paid enough to do it to make it worth my while, depending on what you're planning on doing? And the answer may not always be yes. It may be sometimes like, this is more work than I want to do for this rate. And that's okay. That's okay.
And sometimes you take that deal.
Yeah, and sometimes you take the deal because you want something out there.
Sometimes it's or you just want to be part of that project. Or,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, being part of the project. So one thing we mentioned very briefly was, you know, don't work for free. But I do want to give the exception to that. And it's what Phil just said. If you want to be part of a project, the initial Savage Insider editions was through Mystical Three Entertainment. It's Aaron Huss and Emmy, the two of us. We were doing all the editing and all of the, he was doing all the layout at the time, because at the time I didn't have that skill. I do now. So I, looking at that, he was doing all of that, the editing, and we were going back and forth between each of us running the issues and finding people to create the content. And we were both doing it for free. Mm-hmm. Because we both love Savage Worlds, and you know, I had at the time I was not yet a publisher. That changed before it changed hands to us. But you know, I was doing it for free. He was doing it for free. We were having fun. We were doing it as a labor of love. We enjoyed getting in touch with people who were in the industry. We enjoyed getting in touch with other licensees. We enjoyed actually having some interaction with Pinnacle themselves. So that was cool. We did it for free. And then eventually he decided that it was a lot of work to do for free. And I told him, I totally get that. And in the meantime, I became a publisher, and I decided I would offer to continue its publication under our banner. And that was the exception. It was doing something like that for free. What we're doing up here today, we're doing this for free.
Yeah, I think the clarification there is, don't work for other people for free. Don't expect people to work for you for free.
Right.
Yep. When you are a publisher for yourself, it will occasionally be, or often, be for free or even negative money.
Yep. When you're starting, definitely.
So
definitely.
Be aware of that.
What was that? I had one thought when you were talking about free, and it's escaping me, so I'm going to think for a moment. But
it'll come back.
Jump back in.
It'll jump back.
So if you do choose to do something for someone else for free, though, make sure that it's not the start of a bad habit.
Yeah.
Because doing something for someone else for free once or twice, because going back to Phil's comment about if it's something you love because you just want to be part of that project, that's one thing. But it should be the one-off. It shouldn't be what you're doing all the time.
Yeah, and avoid that trap where people are like, well, this will get you exposure.
Oh, yeah, exposure does not pay your bills.
Exposure,
trust me.
Right.
Your
work is worth something.
Yes.
I've taken people who've asked. I will always try to pay going rate. Like, even if people ask for less, that to me is important. And even if that means that I can't quite buy everything I want. Because again, my one favorite artist, you know, will try to undercut his price, and I'm like, no, I will come back and buy more artwork from you when I can pay you full price. But sometimes, you know, sometimes there's an ebb and flow of money where, you know, I can buy a couple pieces now and this will get me by for right now, and then I'll come back and get some more.
So I'd like to mention a couple of things. For those of you who are thinking, you know, that you might want to become publishers or give your, you know, or even if you don't want to become a full-blown publisher, but you have something of yours you'd like to put out at least once, art is expensive, writing is expensive, editing is expensive. Art is probably the most expensive part of it. But there are some resources where you can do things like go to graphic stock. That's, you know, where you can buy onesie-twosie images, or you can actually buy subscriptions. So if you go to those kinds of websites, you may be able to buy some things that they're not going to be custom because they're not specifically for you.
Right.
And if you're doing fantasy, you might have, you know, it might be, if you're doing something that's not traditional fantasy with your typical elves and dwarves and orcs and that sort of stuff, it might be harder to find work that's already out there that's in some of these kinds of offering some of these kinds of companies. But you can at least get some things, you know, pictures of shields, pictures of fairies, you know, pictures of starships.
Drive-through stocked with those.
Right, so you may have some of those. And a lot of those don't require that you do attribution by the image. A lot of those just say, you know, somewhere in your work to mention that you've got it. So that might be a way to, particularly when you're starting out, reduce some of your costs. You can do what Phil was mentioning, that buy something nice from somebody you want to support with the hope that later you make more money so you can buy more, but then you can supplement it with other things. Mm-hmm. But try to make sure the styles are at least somewhere in the same vein, so you don't have something that's this black and white Art Deco style, and then you've got something else that is this very comic strip looking illustration. So I think early on, I think both Phil and Eric mentioned consistency. So consistency in your artwork, consistency in your editing, consistency in your writing, even if you have multiple people working with you, making sure that it has a consistent tone of voice, a consistent kind of look. And if it doesn't, that doesn't look as if it's an error, that it looks as if it's intentional. You know, so you can do things that are inconsistent in style if you do it so that it looks intentional. I think of it as sometimes you'll read a book where it's a different point of view for different chapters. So those styles are very obviously different, but it's for a reason, and it's clear, it's intentional, not accidental. So keep that in mind if you end up working with different people to help you with your projects.
You had a question.
We're talking about rights for artists and such. Earlier you mentioned that maybe a product doesn't get published. What happens to the rights for something that doesn't get published? Do you set it up so that they go back to the artist?
That should be in the contract. That should be established in the contract. If this doesn't get published, do the rights revert? That's the wording that you're looking for, is rights reverting, reversion of rights, things of that nature. So the word revert is usually what you're going to see in contracts. Where do the rights go if that publication never actually sees the light of day? So look for that. Personally, I would look for those rights to come back to me. Again, because Ben burned. Yeah. And it's like, wrote this whole big thing, never got published, and now can I use those? Can I use any part of what I did? Yeah. You know, so that would be what I'd look for. Yes?
So I know what you do for this question, but for you guys. So one of the stumbling blocks for many publishers sometimes is buying the art and then finding out the person just copied someone else's art. What steps do you do, because it's harder than just searching on the web for written word, to ensure that your art is...
Yeah, I mean, Google image search helps with that these days. It has become an important tool. By the way, there's a great resource for what not to do. If you're on Google Plus, join the Kicksnarker Google Plus group.
I haven't heard
that. It is a fantastic group for kick snarker. It is exactly what you think it is. It is a lot of people who look at especially RPG and board game Kickstarters and say, wow, here are the things that are wrong with this one. You start to see it when you're hanging out there. But I have not had to deal with that. It is very much trying to know my artists as much as possible beforehand. I have been fortunate in that most of them I have known personally, or I know that they are professionals before I hire them.
Yeah, I think I wind up being fortunate that, again, with Encoded, so part of the way we formed Encoded was that a number of us all wanted to publish stuff, but none of us possessed all the same skills. So we all agreed that we would help publish each other's stuff and all work together. So one of our members, John Arcadian, is our art director. So he has actually for years has been and still does cultivate relationships with artists. And so we buy art from established artists or somebody that John knows either personally or knows through another artist. We've been fortunate in that as well. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, there are people who will, you know, come off quickly like, oh yeah, I can put that together, and then, you know, snap out a Google image search, and it's really... Yeah.
So referrals would be kind of the referrals. Short answer to that.
Yes.
Is,
where else have you worked? Who have you worked for?
Verifiable referrals.
If you have an artist who has proven that they are consistent with deadlines, ask them, hey, do you know anybody who does this?
Right.
I know you don't do blueprints. Do you know somebody who does?
I'm going to add to, so the Kicksnarker is probably the more brutal way.
I've got to check that out.
There's another good resource, actually, if you are a up-and-coming game designer or publisher, and that is the IGDN, the IDGN, the Indie Game Design, developers.
Yeah, right, first one. IGDN.
Yeah, and they're great. You do have to apply for it. There is an application process.
And a vetting process. You don't just give them the money and everybody gets in.
Not everybody gets in.
There is a vetting process.
Yeah, not everybody gets in. You do have to apply for it. But even if you don't, there's a mentorship program where they will partner you up with other publishers and things like that to kind of help you get along.
It's come a long way. I was with them when they started, and I eventually felt like I was good and left it. But yeah, it's a good group to look into.
It's a really good group. And I mean, now there's some really big names in it. Mark Diaz Truman and...
he was with us to begin with.
Yeah, and I mean, now they're, you know, they were super tiny. Now they're doing the
Members have grown. Right, not just the membership, the members have grown.
Magpie Games is technically indie? Maybe not.
They're now like Evil Hat. They're departing indie land. They're going big league.
But on the question of community, which I do want to add on to, this is something that I've really, because Vicky and I did basically this panel a couple of years ago.
Yes,
Gen Con. And so one of the things I just wanted to add that I have learned in that time in between then and now is thinking about this idea of community. Because if you are designing, if you are publishing, you will work better and you'll have more support if you can surround yourself with other people who are doing that. Try to find other people who are doing that. So the IGDN has a very sort of structured mentorship program, and that is absolutely valuable. There is a tendency that I have noticed for... and this is true, this has always been true in every creative endeavor. Up-and-coming people just getting into the thing are like, ooh, there's a group of cool people doing awesome things. I want to get into that group. Don't think that way. Every art movement ever has started with people at about the same place, and they grew up together. And that is true in game design as well. You mm-hmm. see those groups. And those were the people who were like, they were all coming up together in their design process at about the same time, and they developed that relationship. So look for your own group.
Yep.
And support each other. I mean, you guys are so lucky because you basically built one and you've got a company around it. I'm envious of that.
That's pretty cool.
Depending on where you are, just look for that kind of community. And even if you don't have other game designers or other publishers, look for people who are doing other creative things. That cross-media inspiration is strong. It's one of the things that, you know, academics talk about, the ability to walk across from the biology department to the philosophy department and have that feed into research. It makes a huge difference. So surround yourself with other people who are getting started. And talk to the people who are the veterans and learn what they have to know. But don't spend all of your energy saying, oh, if only I could just get into that group, then I'll have everything. No, build your own.
So some ideas on how to get into community or build your community. You probably heard Google Plus mentioned up here. That was the Kickstarter you were talking about was on Google Plus. Look for, if you're on social media, and I hope that is everybody in this room. So if you're on social media, look at Facebook, look at Google Plus for groups, for communities, for pages that are about design, about industry, because you will find those. Google Plus actually has a few of them, and of course none of them are coming to my mind this very second. But if you go on to Google Plus and you use a search tool to find RPG industry, RPG artist, anything with RPG in it, you are likely to end up seeing a plethora of groups that are about RPG. Also going to Facebook. If you go to Facebook, same thing. Looking for groups, looking for pages that are for industry. And the keyword there is actually industry, because you will have places that it's for talking about RPGs, but it's not necessarily talking about being a freelancer or being a developer or being a publisher in the RPG industry. And don't get me wrong, those are great places to hang out, because it gives you kind of an idea of what are people talking about with RPGs. So go those places too. But even places like RPGNet and NWorld have little offshoots of where you'll see people talking about being publishers in the industry or being freelancers. So look for those places within some of the more well-known entities as well. When you start putting your name out there and making comments, I would encourage you to do it with the idea that one day these people may be, A, your consumers, even if you're in the industry, B, they could be your colleagues, C, they could be your partners. So what I mean by all that is, if you have a knee-jerk reaction to something that someone types online, step away from the keyboard. Okay? Yep. We all hear about flame wars. So step away from the keyboard. If you aspire to be someone who you want people to want to work with, you want people to want to pay you for your product, then you have to be very mindful of the presentation you make whenever you're in a public forum, whether that is online or whether it's face-to-face. I'm not saying be fake. Don't be fake. Be you. But be you with the knowledge that the you that you are today could drive what kind of relationship you have with potential partners, employees, employers, or purchasers in the future.
I have seen that happen in the industry a couple of times. There are a couple people I know that have done that, and you just look and you're like on Facebook and you're like, why are you saying that out loud? Like, that's what you say to your group of friends privately, like,
and not on recording,
and not right, and not so, not as a Facebook post.
Absolutely. And on in that same vein, with the idea of what you don't say, it's like, why are you doing this? When you do have customers, same thing. So grow a very, very thick skin. You've got like plus four armor on. Okay.
Prepare for your first one-star review.
Yeah, and be grateful for those one-star reviews, and be grateful for the people who say really crappy and crass things to you, because it gives you an opportunity to first consider if there is some actual merit to whatever vitriol that's being spewed your way, because sometimes there actually are constructive things within the crap. You just have to wash it all off. So that can happen. Second, even if there's nothing constructive in there, it gives you the chance to publicly show what a professional and stand-up act you are.
Yes.
Because you can do things like, thank you very much for commenting on product XYZ. I'm very sorry to hear that you didn't enjoy that. Perhaps you would be interested in these things, or whatever you want to put forward.
Don't say you're wrong.
Telling someone they're wrong is not going to help you. Telling someone that you have been a complete jerk is very rarely going to help you. Let other people come to that conclusion. It's like the people who say, this is the most fantastic game, you will really find it exciting. Well, no, just because you think it's a fantastic game and you find it exciting does not mean that the person who is looking at your text for your game is going to do that. Let them come to their own conclusion. Tell them the things that are true. And this is actually this actually works for both things I'm discussing here, that works for talking, not saying that someone's been a jerk. Let the readers figure that out for themselves and make their own decision. And also marketing, because that's one thing we haven't mentioned at all.
No.
And we only have like 2 minutes left. Marketing. So when you're marketing your products, steer clear of anything that tries to tell a person how great your product is, because they should come to that conclusion on their own. Instead, highlight what your product is, not what you hope they think about your product after they
purchase. Let them gravitate. The people who are interested will gravitate.
Exactly.
To
it. Yep. Now, that's not so you can't use quotes from people who say that it's a great product.
You just put it out.
Yeah, but you make sure it's clear. This is somebody else's opinion. This is what someone else said,
yeah.
As opposed to I'm telling you it's great, because if I open it and you tell me that if you make a comparison to some other product and I don't like that product, then you probably lost me. If you make a comparison to some other product and I play your game or I read your book or whatever I'm doing and it doesn't live up to my expectation because you just told me it was like something else, then that's going to backfire on you. So stick to things that are factual and let other people come to their own conclusions.
My best one-star review ever is, so I wrote this book, Never Unprepared, which is like the Susan Lucci of awards. Like it was nominated, in the year it came out, it was nominated for every award, Golden Geek, Any, Origins, Ward,
nice.
Everything. So it, needless to say, got some really good reviews. But on DriveThru, the second or third review is a one-star review, and it is like 1,000 words long.
Oh, man.
Like, this guy didn't just not like it. He so not liked it that he like wrote like the counter essay to it.
Oh my gosh.
And I mean, I didn't like, I left it alone. Like I was just like, you know,
reply.
Like, nope, it's fine.
Reply.
It's fine. But I guess the thing that I liked about it was like, look, either love the stuff I do or seriously hate the stuff I do. Don't. The worst review you can ever get is like the one star and somebody just puts like, meh. Like, I want you to either hate the stuff, like completely disagree with me in the most passionate ways, or completely agree with me. I never want to be the middle ground. So, yeah, I'm quite proud of that review. The other one I got a one-star review for a free product I put up. It's a hack of lasers and feelings, and it's called Rocker Boys and Vending Machines. It's a fantastic, like, little fun game. If you've ever played Lasers and Feelings, it's the exact same style thing, except it's all cyberpunk. And I use this great artist. Her name is Megan Dornbrock, and she draws these very anime kind of thing. It's very much her style. And so I put it up online, and it was nominated this year for Best Free Product in the Ennies. And there's a one-star review that's like, this game hardly has any rules and childish artwork. And
okay.
I'm like, you kind of missed the whole point of it. Like,
yes, it does.
It's right, like you, and you can, like, you don't, it's free. Like, you're not paying anything. Like, you can just download it and delete it when you're done. But I'm like, well, I couldn't comment on it. I'm like, yeah, that, well, Lasers and Feelings only has like 4 rules. So, yes, it's devoid of rules. And I purposely paid for that artwork. Like, yeah.
So, see, that would have been my thank you for your time. I see that you realized it was a simplistic rule set. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I had a good laugh. I was like, I can't help you. Like, you, everything you don't like about this is exactly what I was intending, so it's okay.
Right. Yeah, that's fantastic.
So we should probably wrap. Phil, where can people find you?
People can find me in a whole host of places. I am the host of 2 podcasts, The Misdirected Mark and Pandas Talking Games. You can find me on EncodedDesigns.com, GnomeStew.com, and you can find me on Twitter at DNAPhil.
And I am Eric Simon on G+. You can tell it's me because I'm the one with the steampunk Darkwing. And I am Fairman Rogers on Twitter various websites and other things, but those will get you started.
The easiest way to get to me is to go to obatron.com. That's OBATRON. Like Nancy, not like Mary.com, and follow all of our little links that say click here to go to Facebook or to Twitter or to whatever else there is, Google+ as well. So you can certainly see me there. As far as professional connections, you can find me at LinkedIn. I connect with people professionally through LinkedIn. I do not connect with people professionally through Facebook, unless you are liking our Obatron Productions page on Facebook. So you can find us there as well. Thank you very much for having us today.
Oh, I'm good.